papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is your half hour of commentary and analysis, and some days even some insight into the news media issues of the past week, and we thank you for joining us. I'm Rex Smith, editor-at-large of the Times Union, with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Dr. Shartok, how are you?
I'm fine, Chief, and I'm glad you're commandeering the show as you always do. No, I didn't mean commandeering. I meant commanding the show.
We'll see if I have to commandeer to keep you in line. I'll do my very best, you know?
I know you will.
Always do it. It's just a very tough task, very tough. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, professor, editor. Well, you can't say jack of all trades. That's gender specific, isn't it?
How about Jackie?
Yep.
Yeah, that works.
And Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle is here, reporter, editor, and general woman of the, I started to say woman of the Ozarks, those are the Berkshires, aren't they, wherever it is. where are you?
Ew.
How dare you?
One of those
I'm simply stellar.
Absolutely, that's great. We're all glad to be here and here to talk about the media issues of the past week. I saw, you know, there is so much news out there and so much of it is actually unsettling. That one of the topics that our producer, David Gustina, suggested we talk about is news avoidance. People who are actually actively turning away from the news. And it turns out that there's been some very interesting research about this. A paper that has just come out talking about how people, in which people are avoiding the news. So what kinds of people do you think intentionally turn away from the news? Why would somebody do that? Who wants to speculate on what would motivate people to do that or who would be most likely to do that?
I'll do a speculation. I hear from people who hate Trump, and they say, I will not turn the television on because I'm going to see Trump. And I don't want to see him, even if he's making an idiot out of himself. I don't want to see him. And I keep saying, but he's the president. He sets policy for the country. You got to know what he's up to. No, I don't. I don't like him, and I'm not going to watch him.
Hmm. So you think that there's some ideology at stake there, that people don't want something that the news that interferes with their ideological bent?
Well, we know that. We know that because we know it from people who watch Fox. They don't want to watch anything except what they agree with and what agrees with them. Same thing maybe for MSNBC, to a lesser degree, CNN. So people go where they are liked. And I know we're going to talk about it this week because we talked about it last week, and Rosemary is really on top of this one. And that has to do with the New York Times and the fact that there are people at the Times who are leaving because they say there's only one way to look at the news, and that's our more liberal way, and otherwise we want you out of here. Right, Rosemary?
Yeah, that's the big controversy of the week, the resignation, the very public, loud, whiny resignation of Barry Weiss.
B-A-R-I, by the way, for people who haven't been following this as a woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Right. Well,
I want to go back, though, Rex, because I think Alan's right. Ideological reasons keep you away from the news. But so does saturation. I cannot listen to one more thing about climate change. Add it to saturation. There's so much coverage of it. I don't want to read it. And a lot of it is repetitive. I don't feel like I can do anything about it. So I just don't listen to it anymore.
Jen, have you ever, you're a reporter, you have to pay attention to the news, but do you ever want to skip it?
You know, I am very choosy about when, and I'm very intentional when I am looking at news as a consumer. It was interesting. Last week, I was working with a class virtually, of course, through Simon's Rock. And so I was in a room full of young international students who happened to be all women. And we started the session off by asking, where do you get the news? And I was actually impressed at how savvy some of these young women were and what stood out to me was that people are having a hard time trusting news sources. Some of the students I spoke with, and then, you know, these are college age, young college age students, and they were acutely aware at who's funding big media, and that they said that had sort of disenfranchised them a bit. Some, you know, wonder whether they're getting the full truth when they do or don't see representation of themselves. So I was on a call with young women from everywhere, from New York City to Bangladesh and Afghanistan, and the news is definitely skewed when it comes to representing people's voices. So that is a point of being disfranchised. Myself, I look at everyday local news sources, national news sources, and then news sources from around the world just to gain perspective. And you could look the same subject up, but you could find very different stories.
You know, I'm taken by how much each of you have said something that does actually fit in with what these researchers found, that younger people and women tend to avoid the news more frequently, although education has no significant relationship with it. But people with higher levels of trust in the news are less likely to avoid the news. Now, that may sound very easy to sustain, but when you talk, Jen, about your students from around the world, places with a freer press where people have more confidence that what they're reading is actually potentially true are less likely to avoid it. But ideology is, in fact, a predictor. And Alan, to your point, slightly, people on the left who you primarily hear from are actually more likely to say, I'm going to avoid it, I'm going to turn away from the news, than people on the right. So perhaps this is unsurprising, but with the saturation level of news, you can certainly understand why we sometimes, especially with so much news that sounds so bad these days, it's hard right. not to say we want to get out of it, right?
Yeah. I notice in Jen's newspaper, which I read assiduously every day, if somebody dares to write a letter which is either conservative or moderate in its, you know, tone, they get flooded. So newspaper editors, to some degree, follow what they think their people want to hear. And I think there is a difference in the way in which different newspapers play that. But if you're an editor, you're keeping your eye on that, don't you think, Jen?
Yeah, I think that sort of leads into some of the issues that the New York Times, for example, is having is, you know, what is editorial policy? What is staff practice? And sometimes there are clearly clashes, and sometimes it rears its head in a very ugly way. But these are things that we do need to be aware of in the media, is that everything we do is on a public scale and public display. And we have to be, you know, not only super savvy about our own jobs, but also very hyper aware of how these impressions play out in the public sphere.
You know, it's interesting. You two seem to be saying somewhat the same thing, but somewhat differently. And by the way, I want to make it clear that when Alan talks about newspaper editors paying attention, I'm sure he's not intentionally ignoring radio and broadcast and television producers.
Not at all, Rex. We just do it so much more honestly and better. As long as you're starting off.
Like the first shot.
No, the first shot came moments before that. Go ahead.
But there's a difference, though, between being aware, as Jen is saying, of the audience and what they need to know, and Alan saying that there's a tendency to only reflect a certain bias on the part of the journalists themselves. Now, Rosemary, you were starting to talk about that, about the resignation of this opinion editor, Barry Weiss, at the New York Times. What about that?
Yeah, very interesting case. She's been highly controversial, mostly because she takes a completely pro-Israel, totally anti-Palestinian point of view that has gotten her in trouble. She's kind of prickly. If anyone disagrees with her, she sees it as bullying. And she got caught up, I think, in the Tom Cotton controversy, which we have discussed here. Tom Cotton, a very conservative senator and possible future Secretary of Defense, argued for sending in troops against any protesters, peaceful protesters in the country. And staffers at the New York Times rebelled against this. Some 800 signed a letter saying it was shoddy of the paper to have let in this op-ed full of opinion, which is interesting, and unchecked facts. And as a result of that, the paper essentially apologized for the article, and Weiss's boss, Jim Bennett, the head of the editorial page, quit. And I said at the time, wow, I would have run the editorial. An op-ed is full of opinion. Mm-hmm. Even if it's odious opinion, you have to listen to it, especially when it comes from someone who has the power to make that opinion policy. And when I saw 800 people standing up to it and the paper backing down, I said, wow, definitely time for me to get out of the business. I'm not with it anymore. Maybe it's time for new thinking. So when I first heard about her resigning, saying it's outrageous that you rise up against a really conservative, again, odious opinion, and liberal opinion gets in all the time with just as much unchecked, supposedly unchecked fact as of what you saw in Tom Cotton's, I said, good, great, this is right. We should be showing everything. That's what newspapers do. But she made her resignation in such a way, she wrote a 1,500-word resignation letter. She put it in a public place, so now it's everywhere. And it just rips apart one of the best journalism organizations in the world and left it open to criticism by conservative media, right-wing media, and at no real cost to herself, may I add, because she'll end up in a right-wing newspaper or a public outlet of some sort, or may even start her own. So she's not hurt, but she did really slam the New York Times in a way that made it difficult for them to respond. So I'm of two minds about this. I like the position she's sticking up for, and I wish that some liberals would. She is a self-described centrist, and she says anybody who's more liberal than she is attacks her at the paper. I also find that really, really, you know, she can't handle, she takes a job with the New York Times, not exactly unknown as a liberal bastion, and then can't stand up to criticism of her point of view. So I'm very mixed up on it, and I would love to hear the opinion of my co-panelists today about this.
And let's just make clear to people that this woman worked for the opinion pages, as you said, and she's somebody that most New York Times readers would never have encountered. Part of her job was to seek out opinion pieces on various topics to bring them onto the opinion pages of the paper, not the news coverage. She's not a part of the news coverage, didn't report to the editor, reported to the opinion editor who reports to the publisher. But she's saying that the general orthodoxy of the paper is on the left and that she was shouted down. She said there is a civil war, that was her words going on at the Times, between the mostly young wokes and the mostly 40-plus liberals. Liberals being, I guess she meant establishment liberals. So, yeah, it's really an airing of the internal goings-on of the Times that you don't ordinarily see at a newspaper. And, of course, being in management, I'm a bit over the last 20 years of my career, or 30 years, I'm sensitive to the fact that you really can't say much about an employee who departs. You really are rather limited as to what you're able to say, except the person worked here. But one of her colleagues said, it's not a civil war, it's an editorial conversation, and it's not breaking down along generational lines.
Well, first of all, the New York Times, I think many of us will agree, is, as Rosemary has already alluded to, is probably the best newspaper in the country, if not the world. So we begin with that. And I loved your word orthodoxy, Rex, because there is an orthodoxy that goes on in some of these places. And when you remind me about public radio and public television every once in a while, that it's, we're not only talking about newspapers, I think it's fairly clear that WNYC, for example, in New York, has had its share of these very similar problems. And you know it because you're a friend of one of the incoming people who has already gotten terrible reviews before she even gets there, based on, this isn't what we thought. This person should be black. Our news person should be black. This should happen. So I do think this concept of orthodoxy in news organizations is terribly important, and that we have to keep our eye on it, because otherwise we will have lost a valuable resource, which brings us all of it. I couldn't agree more with you and with others. I think I agree with all of you that they should have printed the Cotton editorial. If he's an idiot, let people see he's an idiot.
I was with this discussion that took place actually on the round table, and I was the outlier in the group where I didn't agree that the editorial should have been published in the way that it had, in that it did contain some things that I felt merited fact-checking, and that it should have had a conversation, you know, with the staff beforehand because of the timing of a lot of it. And I think that was what manifested both in this case and Barry Weiss. A couple notes, though, on Barry Weiss is that this is not the first time that she's faced controversy, and she's discussed it really publicly, especially on Bill Maher's show, who that host in particular seems to have an empathetic ear for her as well. And so those grievances have been discussed before. And here's another thing that I find interesting is that a lot of this controversy is stirred by social media, specifically Twitter. And with Barry, she was given a platform, first of all. So she wasn't censored in that way. The New York Times gave her a platform to say what she needed to say and to bring into voices, as she listed, I think, 20 of them in her letter that she brought to the table. So that's a fact you can't deny. You know, she also chose to resign. But I think in terms of how things played out, I think that's a matter of management that you do have to look at. One of the things I was curious about was just looking at the Times' own policies and its employee handbooks of, you know, how you're supposed to deal with this internal culture, which is totally leaked out on Twitter. The conversations, the things that you quoted, Rex, actually came from a Slack channel, which is supposed to be internal and encrypted, and yet it still made it out in the public domain. You know, not everyone on staff is going to get along, but when you are the New York Times and you are going to have controversy, you need to figure out how you're going to communicate that.
I think your point is correct. When you have 1,500 people in a newsroom, there's going to be controversy. And some people are going to be leaking, quote unquote, which news organizations rely upon. Rosemary?
Well, I want to add, I think that's very wise what Jen is talking about. But let's add to the mix the reason that Weiss and others have been hired at the Times is a deliberate effort to get voices different than that liberal voice that she is attacking. It came after the 2016 election, which the Times got wrong, had predicted wrong, and they wanted to get better in touch with other voices in the United States. And as she pointed out, 20 people at least more, she said many more than the ones she listed, those voices had gotten into the paper, which undercuts her argument that there's not a willingness to listen to other ideas. There's actually quite a concerted effort to get those other ideas in. It's also not surprising that there's conflict when you get in those conflicting ideas. If everybody were a liberal establishment liberal, there'd be great homogeneity and there would be no conflict. So I think that actually that's a sign of health in the newsroom.
And, you know, we don't know all of it. You and I have talked about this before, Rosemary. Her boss gets fired and she's next out the door. Not an unusual situation, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing that does go on. And I think it's fair to say that every newspaper has its people who are disquieted, who are angry about being there. I have to say that the little I know about it, the more I think this is disgraceful for the Times to have done this.
I'm sorry, disgraceful for the Times in what way? What did the Times do that's disgraceful?
Well, if they pressured her, as she says, right? And if, in fact, she's been subjected to bullying and harassment and that they didn't step in, that would be disgraceful.
It would be if that were true.
Yeah, as I just said, Rex, I try to say what I mean, and then quite frequently, you know, you say, if that's true, well, yeah, if it's true.
We always try to say what we mean. It's a good thing. So, as you said, Alan, we don't really know. You know, when I first arrived at the Times Union years ago as managing editor, there had been an effort to bring in different points of view on the editorial page, on the opinion page. There was an editorial page editor who was on the left, let's say, and a chief editorial writer who was on the right. And I think that people could have gotten whiplash from one day to the next, depending upon who wrote the editorial, as to whether the opinion page is more liberal or conservative. And you kind of expect a sense of stability in the opinion pages themselves. What is the voice of the newspaper? Again, as differentiated from the news coverage, which we hope will be straightforward and not have a bias reflected. But newspapers created the op-ed page intentionally to bring in voices beyond their own, beyond the staff and the editorial board. Remember, op-ed means opposite editorial. It is the page that faces the editorial page. The Times pioneered this in the 1960s, and other newspapers across the country have followed, and there is a lot more diversity of viewpoints on these op-ed pages than there ever used to be. And I think the hiring of Barry Weiss is a reflection of that. And I would bet you that whoever they hire to fill her position will also reflect a set of opinions that differs from that of the sort of majority of the editorial board. I bet they're going to go out and find someone that sort of reflects that more conservative point of view, because you have to have that diversity if you're going to reach the whole audience.
Now they will.
Right, Rex. But I think the issue here is, an issue that they should resolve before they onboard someone and before things continue to get so ugly is the difference between editorial pages, whether it be in the print edition or online, versus where the root of this issue is playing out, which is on social media, namely Twitter, which is what Barry talks about extensively in her letter, is saying that, you know, these mobs exist on Twitter, that Twitter is all but on the masthead of the New York Times. And I think that's the root cause of the issue. And this is where the playing field is changed. And I think that's where you have to reel back in sort of decorum and say, how are we talking to each other? Yes, if you're going to bring an opposite voice on and it's going to even, you know, upset our staff, you need to have conversations in person and internally and not on social media channels. This is where Barry did a lot of her backpedaling too. She would tweet out some things, her own opinion, which she's absolutely entitled to, especially as an opinion columnist. But then she would get criticized by a lot of people on social media, and then she would backpedal on things or delete tweets, and things got even worse. And we see this happening time and time again at a lot of media outlets, not just the Times. And I think this is something you have to get under control.
But it doesn't happen at your paper, Jen. It doesn't happen at Rex's paper that people resort to tweets, not that I know about, criticizing their leadership. So there's something unique about the Times, perhaps, and maybe WNYC in New York, which has had some real havoc there. And maybe when some organizations get big, this becomes something that's allowable. I don't know. Rosemary, I know you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I disagree. I think there's nothing but good that comes from readers and listeners seeing what goes on behind the closed doors of a newsroom. If I hear one more time that, oh, you know, the media did this, like we have a meeting every day and we get our marching orders on what to do and we coordinate one with the other when nothing is further than the truth, how can it be bad that Twitter and all that attacks an opinion they don't like and that they see that in the same newsroom different opinions exist?
It's part of their policy. If you go to the New York Times website and look at their policies, you know, they are held to very specific standards. And that's the thing, like these policies have been completely blown out of the water. So, and specifically talking about the New York Times.
What policies in particular are you talking about, Jen, first? Which clause are you talking about?
The part that says that your social media is considered part of your extension of the paper, essentially. And this is something that's been bandied about across staff, not just with Barry Weiss, you know, across multiple staff. And actually, it says clearly in the guidelines that these social media guidelines were developed by about half a dozen New York Times staffers themselves. And they explain why their policies are the way they are. But in this situation, and again, as talking about the specific case, as Barry points out, you know, she's blaming Twitter a lot on this. And I think you can't ignore that.
That's true, but she wasn't fired. She opted to leave. And I would say
exactly
that her speaking out and backpedaling and all that was just fine. I loved her on the Mars show. Again, I think it's good. And, you know, here's one other thing. Her boss was fired. He did not opt to leave. He was fired over that Cotton editorial. And you did not see him attacking the institution. So the New York Times essentially brought a viper into its nest on purpose, because they wanted a different voice. By every indication, including her own, she was successful in doing that. Her own voice and the 20 and more people that she got into the paper since 2016 are proof of that. And then she attacked them. She didn't just leave. She didn't go to the top people and say, look, we're doing this all wrong. This is awful. So to blame it on Twitter or on the paper, I think it was her.
Okay, but we don't know. Here's the point. We don't know. Her boss gets fired, whether she was next, whether the axe was next to her head. We just don't know that. And as you have perceptively pointed out, if you're the management, you don't tell those stories for all kinds of legal and other reasons. You just shut up and let it go away, and it will. So,
okay, fine. You know, but in 15 words in her resignation, if they were after her job, I have a feeling she would have mentioned something about that.
Well, she did say bullying.
If they were going to be firing her, she would have said, I was pushed out, and she did
pressured.
Not. She made it very
right.
clear that this was her choice, and she did it because she was mad.
Yep.
I still don't know.
You know, one of the difficulties here, which we don't have much time to address here, is that people need to understand the difference between the opinions and straight news coverage. And new research has come out just showing that most people do not, especially digital news consumers, people who are getting the news online. We are not helping people very much by our digital presentation, understanding the difference between this, what Rosemary describes as this very healthy interchange of differing ideologies and points of view in opinion coverage, and what we believe to be honest and fair news coverage.
As you know, Rex, I don't believe you. I don't agree with you, and I don't believe you. And I say that with all the love in my heart that one can feel towards another person. But I think there's substantial bleed from the editorial pages into who gets hired and what they say and what the news columns look like. And we've duked that out before, and we will again.
Well, okay.
Okay, okay. What? Okay, what?
Do you have any examples or evidence of this, Alan?
Yes, every day I read the New York Times, and I just am very fascinated by the juxtaposition of the editorial policy and the way in which first paragraphs, second paragraphs are constructed. You know, there's always an attempt to say he said, she said, but I pretty well can read the way in which it's all set up. And that's true, by the way, in a lot of other newspapers. I will compliment Rex to some degree, because I think his newspaper has not been that way, and people consider it, sometimes they consider that boring. That's the boring way, as Arlo would say. Yeah. On the other hand, I think in many other newspapers, you can pretty well see who's calling the shot.
I hate to leave this discussion here, but we're out of time. And folks, you'll just have to come back next week to hear if we have any rejoinders to that. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Maybe some of us won't be here. No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe we'll go off in a huff with a 1,500-word letter of resignation. Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle, investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, Dr. Alan Chartok, he the professor of Northeast Public Radio, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina, for starting us on all this, and to you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.